T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
And this hour, we're joined in studio by Dr. Howard Hitzel, president of Best Self Behavioral Health, as we turn our focus this hour to mental health. Dr. Hitzel, thanks for coming in. How do people come to you?
Through a number of different avenues. They can just walk into one of our clinics or call our intake department, who will explain to them what their options are in terms of locations and services. Our intake number is 716-884-0888. They're often referred by their primary care physicians, school counselors, a number of different avenues.
Hey, you mentioned referred by physicians or school counselors. I would have to imagine that might be the toughest part of dealing with mental health, is that initial, you know, finding out, do I need help and where to go?
Yes, very much so. I think people find it challenging sometimes. And I think that one of the things that we've really come to focus on is access to care. So we want to make sure that care is readily available and people know how to get into our clinics.
With teens especially, they're coming in mostly undiagnosed, right?
Yes, very often, yes.
What kind of, describe what when teens come in, what kind of screening that they go through?
Well, we do a very standard intake evaluation to find out exactly what the presenting problem is, and that'll often be, you know, information from not only the teen themselves in terms of what kind of discomfort or worries that they have, but also concerns of their family, their parents perhaps, or the school, or whatever other kind of environments they're in that where they may be having difficulty.
Do you find people in that age group, that teens, adolescents, are hesitant to get help?
It varies. I think boys tend to be a little bit more hesitant than girls and are seen with less frequency very often. But yes, it's like anything else that's new. You know, they're not sure exactly what treatment is going to involve very often. They're a little bit afraid of talking about their personal issues. And so there is some reluctance. And I think one of our first jobs is actually to make sure that we reassure young people that this is we're there to help them. I also think it's important that young people find a therapist, a counselor, who's a good fit for them. So I often advise parents and young people, sometimes they need to shop around a little bit and find someone that they trust, who they feel they have some confidence that they'll help them, and it's a good fit, because that really will determine what kind of experience they're going to have going
forward. You need a good relationship, right?
Absolutely, and that's really the foundation of counseling.
Well, the talk is for tougher mental health screening in this country. How does that compare to what we have right now?
Yeah, and I don't know if I'd call it tougher. I think that screening has to be more available. I think it's been recognized that, you know, the statistics say that about 1 in 5 adolescents age 13 to 18 will have some kind of emotional difficulty at some point in time. So I think there's a greater realization that we haven't asked kids enough about whether they're having difficulties. So I think the new standard in pediatric practices now is to routinely screen all teenagers for things like depression and anxiety, because what we know is that if you don't ask young people if they're having a problem, you're very often not going to know. So it really is just a more thorough, comprehensive screening process, so that we're making sure that young people who are having difficulties or suffering in some way will have help available to them.
That 1 in 5 number, it almost seems like to me, given, you know, all the different issues that can come up, and just kind of how present day works, where the way we communicate with each other is so different. I mean, have you noticed social media, you know, being connected the way that we are, having a big impact on your industry?
Well, I certainly think, especially for young people, social media poses a challenge. You know, very often young people can get caught up with with very negativistic things in social media. We've all heard about the bullying that goes on in social media. Sometimes kids get overly involved with their phones. So yes, and I think that some kids are more prone to that than others. But it is certainly an issue, and it is a problem that we didn't have to deal with a number of years ago. Yes.
Still, that 1 in 5 is sticking with me too. But I'm just wondering how many people are walking around today with mental illness that we don't know.
Yeah, well, we estimate that probably only somewhere between a third and a half of people who actually have an emotional problem get treatment for it. So a large number of folks who would benefit from care really don't get it. And a lot of that has to do with the stigma associated with emotional problems, with mental illnesses. So we're trying to do a lot more education to let people know that it's a very common difficulty. We all know people who have emotional problems, whether it's, you know, our parents, our kids, our neighbors, a coworker. These are very, very common ailments. And we really just need to reassure people that there's nothing wrong with them. This is not a character fault. It's not unlike any other kind of medical illness. Sometimes people are just going to have these problems. And they're really very treatable problems. And that's what we're trying to remind people of.
Our conversation this morning continues with Dr. Howard Hitzel, the president of Best Self Behavioral Health, joining us live in studio, talking, well, everything about mental health awareness. And one of the things I was curious is, we talk a lot about the stigma surrounding mental health. And in the wake of the Parkland shooting, I'm wondering if all this discussion has helped or hurt that stigma.
Well, that's a great question, and I think it's probably a little bit of both. On one hand, we certainly want people to be aware of mental health issues and encourage people to seek out treatment where it's needed. So I think just the awareness that that people have these difficulties is important, and that was kind of raised through this incident. However, we want to be careful because most people who have a mental illness are not violent. They don't commit these kinds of crimes. So in some respects, we're cautious because these incidents can contribute to the stigma that already exists around mental illnesses. So we don't want to support that. In fact, the incidence of violence among people with mental illness isn't much different than it is among the regular population. And in fact, people with mental illness are more likely to be victims of crimes than perpetrators.
All right. We're going to have you put your headphones on. We're going to take a call right now from
Sure.
Tony and Clarence. Tony, you have a question for Dr. Hitzel.
Yes, I do. And first of all, you're providing a wonderful service today. I've listened since 5:30, 6 o'clock, and it's just been a great program. So thank you to your Tim Winger and to yourselves for being there. My question is very simple. The president has said that mental health is one of the issues that should be addressed, but the budget has cut the funding to mental health by quite a bit. So how can we have better mental health out there for students and the general public when the funding has been dried up? It's going to dry up.
All right, Tony, thank you for that. Let's get an answer from Dr. Hitzel.
Well, Tony, that's a great question. Very often, I think there's a lot of lip service given to funding for behavioral health services, and then the money doesn't really show up. Some of the things that have really helped in the last few years have been going back a number of years ago, the Mental Health Parity Act required health insurance plans to offer benefits for behavioral health services that were comparable to their medical surgical services. So that really prohibited large insurance plans from restricting behavioral health care in their benefits. And then the Affordable Care Act required most insurance plans to offer mental health and substance use services, which really resulted in an expansion of benefits to about 174 million people across the country. So a benefit of the Affordable Care Act was that people had much greater access to mental health care. And we've seen that in the last number of years. people can access care because they have insurance. Young people, for example, again, attributed to the ACA, now receive health insurance until they're age 26. So this is that vulnerable age very often, late teens and early 20s, where people may first experience a mental illness. And so just the availability of insurance, the availability of services for that population has been critical. So we are really hopeful that that does not get undermined in any way.
12 Voices in 12 Hours continues with Dr. Howard Hitzel. And so much of this discussion, I feel like, has become one side versus the other. You have a side who says, no, this is a mental health problem. You have another side, no, this is a guns problem. Are the two exclusive to one another, or is there some ground in the middle, do you think?
Well, yeah, I don't think it is exclusively a mental health problem. I think that there's a certain level of violence in our culture now that that we need to be concerned about, and certainly access to firearms is one of those things. There's a lot of talk about delaying the age at which young people can acquire guns, and I really think that if you look at just maturation of adolescence, it's a slow process, and very often just cognitively, neurologically, young people don't mature until very often their early 20s. So I think there's other things that we restrict their access to until 21. For example, alcohol. You can't across the country, you really can't purchase alcohol until you're 21, which really suggests that there is some understanding that developmentally, young people need more time to use good judgment and manage themselves. So I think that's, I would be very supportive of that in terms of the acquisition of firearms.
Yeah, I'm just curious. There are mental health regulations, both federal and state. With the SAFE Act in New York State, does that make it any more stronger here?
Probably, yeah. I think that there is more provisions to restrict access to firearms, and I don't think that that's a bad thing. I know that a lot of people are very protective of the Second Amendment rights, but I think we have to use good judgment in terms of what's really appropriate.
You mentioned that maturation process. Has it slowed as we've gone through time? Are we less mature as we hit, whether it's 18 or 21?
That's a great question, and there's been some recent studies that have suggested that that young people are maturing somewhat more slowly. They see it in things like, and some of it's good, the age at which young people first use alcohol, for example, has gotten a little bit later. But things also like getting driver's licenses and those kinds of things are happening at a later time. So yes, there does seem to be some greater delay. Young people are very often living with their parents a little bit longer, they're going to school, that kind of thing. So I think just our society has created this thing where young people are they're just not maturing, kind of taking on new responsibilities as early as they once did.
Is maybe society kind of slow to catch up to that idea?
Could be. Yeah, I think it's that's very possible. Yeah.
Something that teens are dealing with today that teens weren't dealing with 20 or even longer years ago, social media and video games, some of them violent.
Yes.
Video games. How much of this is a factor in what you do with these teens?
Yeah, I don't think we really understand all of the impact of video games. Very often I hear parents complain that they are fearful that their young person spends too much time playing video games. They're kind of hunkered down in their bedroom, and they may actually play with other young people online, but still it's a lot of time consumed. And I think parents' concern is that that's time that they're not spending being with their friends, doing athletic activities or other recreational kinds of things. So it's really what's a healthy proportion of time that young people should spend playing video games. And I think, as was mentioned in the earlier segment, there's video games have a very violent content, and we're not sure, I don't believe, what the effect of that is on young people.
What's a healthy amount of time to be playing a video game?
Yeah, well, you know,
ask the doctor.
I don't know if there's a standard for that, but and I think everybody has to know their child, and I think it depends how that works in the context of a lot of other things. You know, how are they getting along with their family? How are they doing in school? Do they have other activities, things that they enjoy doing? Video games, like everything else, should just be part of their life, not the major focus. So parents should exercise some judgment about that with their young people.
We're back with Dr. Howard Hitzel, president of Best Self Behavioral Health. We're talking about the mental health aspect of school security and gun violence. And I want to bring you back, Dr. Hitzel, to something that Niagara Falls School Superintendent Mark Laurie told us this morning. And it stems from our last subject, which was social media and video games. Social media, he says, 80% of their discipline problems at Niagara Falls City High School stem from social media. Does that surprise you in any way?
No, I can. I believe that. You know, there's just so much interaction on social media, and very often young people just say things to each other and about each other on social media that they would very unlikely that they would say that in person. So I think there's just a level of cruelty, really, and that happens. And some kids get really hurt by it if they become the focus of a group of kids who are trying to harm them.
Is there a disconnect between, you know, the virtual world and the real world that kind of we don't realize with how much time kids spend online and in video games? You know, I look at video games and think, oh, it's so easy to, you know, it's a video game. It's not real life, but the lines can be kind of blurred sometimes.
Well, I think, sir, for some, you know, adolescence is a tough time, and part of the difficulty is really kind of struggling through growing up and developing your interpersonal skills and becoming confident and more sure of yourself. And very often, some young people gravitate to video games because it's a comfortable place for them. They like that. And so they become a problem when their kids are doing video games, playing video games to the exclusion of other things that they need to be doing, whether that be socializing with their friends, spending time with their family, engaging in social recreational activities, that kind of thing. So when it becomes a predominant part of their life to the exclusion of other important things, things that are important to their development, then I think it's a difficulty.
Yeah, like when they go for a job interview and they can't look at the person in the eye, right?
Yes, yeah. It really is. You know, it's an important time to learn personal skills, and video games don't really support that very well.
Has that changed the way that you go about treating different mental health? I would have to imagine that your field has evolved greatly over the last even just 10 years.
Well, I think we just have to be aware of all these pressures that young people experience. And some of it's also just supporting parents. You know, parents very often don't know what the correct boundary should be. And so it's really supporting parents and setting up reasonable boundaries or restrictions on young people and their behavior. You know, very often we always encourage parents to talk to each other, because that's very often a lot of things are going on between their child and their friends, and so it's good for parents to stay connected with one another and compare notes and decide kind of what the rules or standards should be.
Isn't that the problem, that people just aren't talking to each other anymore?
Yeah, very much.
Schedules
so.
Are too busy, and they're just letting things go.
Yes, yeah, and so I think, you know, actively involve parents who are, you know, not being helicopter parents, because there's some difficulties with that also. But knowing your child and knowing what they're doing and who their friends are and what kind of activities they're participating in is important.
12 voices in 12 hours. Our guest this hour, Dr. Howard Hitzel from Best Self Behavioral Health. Dr. Hitzel, there must be some warning signs that people should be observing when there's an issue with mental health. What are they? What should parents especially be looking for?
Yes, I think the things that there's a number of things that parents should look for. And I think one of the things that we really try to communicate is that early intervention, early identification of problems really is important, because it's much easier to address these difficulties before they become more serious. So I would say that you know, watching for any significant change in your young person. You know, are they more angry than they were at one point in time? Are they complaining of being sad or unhappy about things? Are they unable to enjoy pleasurable activities? We often see that with kids. They can withdraw from the things that they used to like. They can become socially isolated. They're not hanging out with their friends anymore, spending more time alone in their bedrooms, perhaps. Some young people feel like they have a hard time controlling their emotions. They become upset or angry or even tearful more often than they used to. Sometimes they just complain of having no energy or no interest in things, and that's a difficulty. Young people sometimes will talk about thoughts of suicide, and I think that's always something that that needs to be taken careful, taken seriously, and considered. Sometimes we see young folks who harm themselves; they cut themselves or burn themselves. That's something that we need to pay attention to. Risk-taking behaviors. This is especially true among boys. You know, they'll be doing things that are dangerous and reckless, and parents need to pay attention to that. So any drastic change in behavior really should warrant their parents' attention. And then the question is, well, what do parents do at that point in time? So I always think that a conversation with your child's pediatrician is a good place to start, always making sure that there's no medical concern that might be going on. Connecting with the school is important because they see they have a big sample of your child's behavior, the school counselor, the school social worker. Are they getting in trouble? How is their academic performance? How do they seem to be getting along with other kids? Are they part of the school culture? And then there's always other parents, talking with other parents to see what's going on with your child's friends, and are there any issues there? And then if you are really concerned, and then seeking out the help of a mental health professional. It's easy to go in and just have a screening, talk to someone who can give you an idea of whether what's going on is something that really needs to get some more attention.
Is there a hesitation by parents, do you find, to admit that there may be a problem, to take some of those next steps?
Very often, I think it's, you know, as parents, we all want our children to be doing well. We don't want them to have problems. And so I think sometimes there is a tendency to minimize it, or just, you know, parents always look back and to their when they were young and, you know, well, it was tough for me too. And so I think sometimes they're not as sensitive to some of the difficulties as they might be. So I think having conversations with young people and listening to them is really important. Again, asking. Sometimes we just don't know we're not going to know what's going on unless we ask those questions.
And we can really have some success in especially early intervention?
Absolutely. I think one of the most important things to know is treatment is really effective. These are all treatable difficulties. And one of the things that I like is when if a child has a good experience in counseling at a young age, they'll learn that this is a resource that they can tap into as they get older. You know, very often, you know, kids have a problem when they're 13 or 14, and then they'll resolve that. But something else may come up when they're 18 or 19. And if they learn that counseling is something that's helpful, they'll figure out that they don't have to always go it alone, that there are people out there who can help them with their difficulties.
12 Voices in 12 Hours continues. A little more time with Dr. Howard Hitzel, president of Best Self Behavioral Health, talking about mental health, which has been a big topic of discussion since the Parkland shooting. We've been talking about treatment, seeking out treatment, some of the warning signs you mentioned in our last segment together. On treatment, you know, I think a lot of people have this idea of, you know, kicking your feet back on a couch and talking to some guy with a beard. That's probably not the way it works, is it?
Not what we commonly see. So the biggest issue with treatment is really access to treatment. So one of the things that we're doing is trying to embed mental health services in schools and pediatric practices. So I think Best Self, for example, has embedded clinics in perhaps 20 schools in Western New York, another six or so pediatric practices. So it's really being accessible. We understand that very often will the easier it is for young people to get care in familiar settings, that can work very, very well. But really, psychotherapy or counseling, primarily with young people, involves helping them develop skills that they need to be successful and feel well. So very often, it's helping them manage their emotions more effectively, helping them solve problems, sort through interpersonal difficulties, the kinds of things that lend themselves to their being either depressed or anxious. And really, depression and anxiety are the most common things that we see, and they're very, very treatable. We often use cognitive behavioral therapy, which is really based on helping young people think about how they think and how their thinking contributes to the emotions that they experience. And very often, if you can help people modify their thinking in a productive kind of way, that they will end up feeling better. There's a specific therapy that we offer for young people called dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, and that's really focused for young people who have a hard time regulating emotions. It really teaches them skills that they need to manage feelings, troublesome feelings that they have, calm themselves very often, and kind of move to a more positive emotional place. But yes, so therapy is usually, you know, you'll see your counselor once or twice, you know, every other week or so, and it's really just a talk therapy. So it's really getting to know that person. Then they will, after an assessment, they'll develop a treatment plan, a means of helping you solve those problems or kind of improve your emotional health.
Now, New York State has a mental health database, right?
They do collect data, yes.
Is it working? If someone were to want to purchase a firearm and they had been seeing a counselor, would mm-hmm. they be prevented?
I think most of the data that they collect is on people who are hospitalized. So I'm not sure with the availability of other data. And some of that gets very difficult to sort through because we don't want to discourage people from getting appropriate mental health care. And that was one of the fears with this whole database. So it's really sorting out people who for a period of time perhaps should not have access to a firearm versus, you know, regular people who are just having some difficulties. Yeah.
Now, we only have a few more minutes, so I want to kind of recycle some of the big important points that we got to today. And first being signs to look for. You mentioned some of those about a half hour ago. I wanted to kind of go through those again. What should, whether it's parents, classmates, teachers, what should people be on the lookout for?
Yeah, well, I think any significant change in behavior over what people had seen before. So if a young person is more withdrawn, if they're expressing feelings of depression or sadness, if they're anxious, if they're having difficulty going to school, if they're withdrawing from activities that they used to enjoy, if they're verbalizing thoughts of hurting themselves, those are all things to pay attention to. If they're having a hard time concentrating, if their schoolwork is deteriorating, that kind of thing.
All right, and another point that you brought up, I think was the first point you made this morning, is that a lot of kids, teens, are going through some difficulties.
Sure. It's a 1 in 5, we estimate. So the important message is treatment is available. And so parents and school counselors should really encourage young people to get the help they need. There's a couple of great resources in Erie County. There's letstalkstigma.org is a website for an anti-stigma campaign. There's the Let's Talk Stigma Coalition, which is a group of providers who are really trying to provide education to the community about mental illnesses and kind of let people know what the resources are. And for young people, there's an initiative from the Mental Health Association called Just Tell One. And it's really directed towards young people, and there's a social media component to it. You can go to justtellone.org, and it's a great way for young people to access care and information, learn about the experiences of other young people that have suffered either from depression, anxiety, substance use, suicidal ideation, that kind of thing.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.